Falter-Podcasts werden durch Werbung unterstützt. Das hilft bei der Finanzierung unseres journalistischen Angebots. Falter Radio, der Podcast mit Raimund Löw.
Sehr herzlich willkommen, meine Damen und Herren, im Falter Radio. Die Streitkräfte der Russischen Föderation zerstören ukrainische Städte. Es gibt 2 bis 3 Millionen Flüchtlinge überall in Europa. Aber nach 3 Wochen des russischen Krieges geben die Ukrainer nicht auf. Russland ist isoliert wie seit Jahrzehnten nicht mehr durch verheerende Wirtschaftssanktionen aus Europa und Amerika. Es laufen Verhandlungen, aber der russische Präsident Putin droht auch mit einer Ausweitung der Offensive. Wieder und wieder erwähnt die russische Führung ihr nukleares Potenzial. Russland verfügt über 6000 Atomwaffen. Noch vor einem Monat hätte niemand dieses Szenario für möglich gehalten. In dieser Sendung hören Sie die führende Russland-Expertin Nina Khrushcheva. Sie unterrichtet an der New School in New York und sie ist Ururenkelin des früheren sowjetischen Parteichefs Nikita Khrushchev, der die Entstalinisierung in der Sowjetunion begonnen hat. Und Sie hören Stephen Lee Myers, den Bürochef der New York Times für China, das der südkoreanischen Hauptstadt Seoul zugeschaltet ist. Stephen Myers war viele Jahre Korrespondent in Moskau. Er hat Wladimir Putin porträtiert in einem bemerkenswerten Buch mit dem Titel »Putin, der neue Zar«. Aufgezeichnet haben wir das Gespräch, das wir auf Englisch geführt haben, im Bruno-Kreisky-Forum am Dienstag, den 15. März 2022, nach einer Nacht, in der von neuem Raketen auf Kiew und andere Städte niedergegangen sind. Ich habe Nina Khrushcheva am Anfang gefragt, wie tief der Einschnitt dieses Krieges mit allen Konsequenzen für die russische Gesellschaft ist.
Well, it is dramatic in a sense that the way we've known Russia for the last 30 years, that Russia is finished. So the way I look at it is it's essentially a coup. And it's an interesting coup that changes the whole perspective of Russia about itself, but also Russia from the point of view of the world. Similar coups happened in 1917, the Bolshevik Revolution, that changed the whole breakdown of global powers and world affairs. 1991, when the Soviet Union collapsed, although it was kind of the Berlin Wall fell in 89, and so that was the transitional moment, also completely watershed for the world. And now this, because it is a war, we talk about, you know, we don't want to start World War III, it is already World War III. I mean, it's fought in hybrid forms, but it is already the two countries fighting in Europe. I mean, one attacked another country in Europe that it claims to be the brotherly nation. So that in itself is just a very dramatic way. So it is a coup, and also the Kremlin coup, although unlike, so it is a revolutionary moment in global affairs. I mean, European Union starts talking about armament. I mean, that's something that, you know, we've never heard for so many years. We haven't heard for so many years. But also what I find really interesting about, not interesting or tragic about those events, is that the coup was made by the same man. I mean, the man who made Russia reasonably, and Stephen, actually, in his book, which is really a remarkable piece of work, and it's translated into German, so, you know, anybody probably absolutely needs to run and buy it and read it immediately, does show the rise of this new czar. But it was the rise.
Putin.
It was Putin, right, the new czar, Putin the first, in a sense. But the new czar, it was, you know, it was a functional, until 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, it was a perfectly functional, not perfect, but functional autocracy, and rather comfortable autocracy for many people. And suddenly, in essentially 10 days, remember that book by John Reed, writing about the Bolshevik Revolution, 10 days that shook the world? In 10 days, Russia went from functional autocracy to full fascism, Taliban, because Putin really, with his attack on Ukraine, with complete crack down on any free anything that is that's inside the country. Also, Stephen actually wrote a wonderful piece in the New York Times. It was called the Eulogy to Glasnost, when suddenly nobody can speak and say and write, and every journalist journalist
you would
fled.
Say a fascist coup?
Fascist is a big word, but in a sense it is. I mean, we as Russians, we invade the country, a neighboring country that really was not a threat in any way possible. That war, Putin's war in Ukraine, is also war with the United States, because Biden promised Putin predictable relationship, didn't deliver. So it is the existential threat, as the foreign minister Lavrov, actually very Western foreign minister Lavrov, suddenly says that Russia has to fight, because otherwise it's an existential threat. But also there's all this incredible crackdown inside Russia. So it is a fascism incarnate. I mean, I know it sounds horrible and I can go to prison for saying that in Russia, but it is a full fascism Taliban coup, because all the restrictions are the Stone Age black hole of Russia now on the par of North Korea, is going to be on the par with North Korea, although much, much larger size. And so in this sense, but what I'm trying also to say is that all of this was orchestrated by one man, the man who made comfortable autocracy, and then the one who destroyed it in one big swoop. So that never happened, but this is something that is certainly going to influence global affairs, Russia's position in the world, because Russia, in a sense, is finished for decades to come, even if the war, and there seem to be promising signs of Ukrainian-Russian negotiations, even if it is done, Russia lost credibility, Russia lost investments, Russia lost 30 years of work on the global stage, Russia essentially the Kremlin essentially eliminated the life of its citizens.
Stephen De Myers, you agree? Usually you would think of a coup in the Kremlin, so in the higher areas of power, but what Nina is describing...
Well, it's one man coup killed his own work.
But what Nina is describing is really a counter-revolutionary coup going from top to bottom in the society.
I think it's a really interesting way to look at something that I think for a lot of people who followed Putin closely remains a mystery and a surprise. Nina mentioned the meeting with Joe Biden, which was only last summer in Geneva, you remember, and there was an effort in that meeting to reset relations with the U.S. and more broadly with the West. And you know, that meeting, as I recall, seemed to go okay. I mean, there wasn't fireworks that would suggest a complete breakdown of the relationship. And something between then and February obviously has changed. And it does seem like something was triggered in Putin to cause him, I think, to miscalculate grossly what the reaction would be to this. And so I don't know if the word coup is right, because it sounds more intentional than I think it might actually be. I think Putin may have made a tremendous mistake here, and he's now having to deal with that. And his reaction, as always when cornered, is to make go into a defensive crouch and take extreme examples, as we saw with the silencing of what voices were still left of a free media and a free society, even more broadly. The question now, I think, is we're only 10 days into this war. And I agree completely that Russia is forever changed by this. But it still remains an open question whether or not Putin can win. And I've always subscribed to the idea that Putin always wins. I mean, he's had a remarkable 22-year run in power. But he cannot reverse this. Even if he were to succeed in conquering Ukraine, which is his stated goal, there's no mystery about what he wants to do, he would still face the isolation from the rest of the world. You know, no country is going to recognize, or very few countries, I should say, would ever recognize, you know, that his end game in Ukraine. If there are promising signs of peace talks now, and let's hope there are, for the sake of the people who are being killed now, it's still going to leave a divided Ukraine. It's still not going to resolve Crimea. It's not going to resolve the question of the Donbas. And, you know, Putin's going to be left presiding over this, his part of a splintered Ukraine, which is also not going to be acceptable. So, other than a total defeat, at which point I think there might be a real coup, not a metaphorical one. You know, I think we're going to, you know, be in this period of great uncertainty and, frankly, tension for the months to come, even years.
Nina Khrushcheva, the goals Stephen mentioned, control of Ukraine, obviously. But behind that, we have this great Russian dreams that go beyond Ukraine. How would you see the goals of this whole new policy from the Kremlin, from Putin, since the war started, or a couple of weeks before?
Well, I wouldn't even say policy anymore, because I don't think it's a policy. It's just a dream, essentially, of one man. And that's why I call it the one-man coup, who sort of makes something happen and then kills it with his own little hands. I think, I mean, it has been a dream, and Putin is a history buff. He says he likes history. He's obsessed with certain subjects, such as World War II, such as Ukraine, such as many wars that Russia as an empire has fought over centuries. If you are on a train in a very comfortable, I don't know if it's going to run anymore, but a very comfortable train from Moscow or St. Petersburg or vice versa, in addition to incredibly comfortable amenities, you are watching the screen in which it says, in 1721, Russia defeated this and that. In 16-something-something, Russia defeated that. In 1100-something or other. So it has been really a sign that it is the glory of Russia is its military victories, that we're not going to be defeated ever. I'm not sure that, Stephen says it's a stated goal, but also the goals of this operation have been changing tremendously. I mean, they're once the beginning was denazification and genocidation, whatever, against the genocide in Donetsk and Luhansk. Fine, those self-proclaimed republics are now recognized by Russia. But then they went into other cities. We don't want to occupy the cities, but we want to denazify them. Now they start speaking about denazification less, but now talk about the official recognition by Ukraine of Crimea. The annexation has to become legal, and those republics within the territories. Also, now Ukraine has to renounce its NATO aspirations and become neutral, the way Austria became neutral in 1955. So it's been changing there. It is possible. I mean, I think Putin may have meant and was told that it's okay that, I mean, because another thing, what's really interesting, and I think what really this event showed, is that this man makes all the decisions. Until, say, pre-COVID or slightly earlier, he still had consultants, and he had groups of people telling him how and where and what. Now it's his economic team was in the dark. They were not prepared for the invasion sanctions. His clandestine team, whatever, the intelligence team was in the dark.
And the Russian elite?
The Russian elite, everybody was in the dark. So he really ran, it seemed like he ran this operation as a clandestine operation. Maybe the military knew something, but the military also didn't know how and much.
Are the elites now supporting this war drive? How would you see that?
Some of the political functionaries do, but there was an incredible meeting at the Security Council on the 22nd of February before the war began, but when the recognition happened. That was a heartbreaking moment because it clearly these people, however many, I don't remember how many of them, 10 or 12, went into that hole where Putin was sitting far away.
And they didn't know what they have to
say. Exactly. They didn't know what they were discussing. And that's why it was such a tension. Wait a minute, are we accepting? Are we taking them? What? So that was a heartbreaking moment because clearly he no longer consults his Security Council and he, because nobody cared in Russia about Donetsk and nobody wanted the war. He clearly doesn't care about public opinion anymore. It's one man.
So the elites are confused.
The elites are confused.
But behind the war drive, they don't oppose it.
No, some oligarchs actually spoke against it quietly and some less so quietly. But I think the oligarchs, I mean, the West was hoping that oligarchs would step up and, you know, want their yachts not to be confiscated. But the thing is, because now the FSB, because basically Putin outsourced the running of the state to FSB, to the security forces. And the security forces can investigate the original wealth of the oligarchs. So they need to be silent. Otherwise, they would lose whatever is left for them in Russia because they already lost their Western parts.
Even Limaya's, the functioning of this Putin regime. In the old Soviet Union, you had the Politburo, you had the Presidium in the Politburo. We know during the Cuba Missile Crisis, the Politburo was meeting all the time. They were discussing what they should do, what they should not do. I mean, what do we know of the way the Putin regime is functioning now?
I think Nina makes the great point that we, from all appearances, can see that he's making decisions largely by himself. Mikhail Ziegler, who's written a fine book on Russia, had an op-ed the other day saying that in his isolation, Putin is has seen very few people, very few other leaders, his own staff. But one of the people who is with him is the banker Yuri Kovalchuk, and a man who he's known going back to Petersburg, who's now heavily sanctioned again, is, you know, a person who's had his ear on a personal level and seems to also be driving some of these notions of empire, of Russian exceptionalism, that is influencing Putin's idea that Ukraine is somehow essentially a part of Russia and can't ever really be sovereign or independent of Russia. And, you know, we don't really know how he came to this decision. As I said earlier, there weren't a lot of signs that he was going down this confrontational road, you know, only a few months ago. And then suddenly, you know, you saw this build up. As far as I know, there were no obvious changes in Ukraine that would have warranted this in any case. But something, some decision was made in his own mind sometime last fall that's led him to put first this enormous pressure by building up the forces. And that's why I think it shouldn't have been a surprise to people, because you don't build a force of 150,000 troops without some intention of using it.
He was posturing. Even Russians
thought he was posturing.
This is not serious.
Absolutely. I was arguing until the last moment.
I mean, except probably the CIA, because the American warnings were exact and were the truth. But many people thought
it's possible it's possible the American intelligence agencies actually know more than we do right now. But I agree that most people looked at what was happening as being a ploy to gain leverage over Ukraine, to intimidate. It's not new. They've had exercises along the border before. But obviously the size of this one gave away its intentions. And that's clear now, especially in hindsight, but it was clear to some people before. And it should have been. I can't imagine it was not clear to the Russian military. They had to have known that they were amassing that kind of force with some purpose in mind other than just the summer or winter training exercise. So, whether or not Putin had made the decision to pull the trigger, and when that buildup began, even in, say, February, before the invasion, it's possible that he himself didn't plan it. But I don't think we know. And Nina's right. There's such a small circle of people around him who might have been in on it, that it left the entire apparatus, the entire state, unprepared for the moment. And I was thinking about this today, even the propaganda arm, which is always so powerful, it's used so effectively by the Russians, didn't seem to be ready, because for weeks up until the invasion, they were parroting the line that this was all hype by the West to discredit Russia, and that it wasn't, they called it hysteria, and so forth. So even the people who should have been primed to justify this relation, or that this invasion should, were unprepared to do so when it actually happened.
If everything really depends on Vladimir Putin, on one person, it seems to be justified to ask the question, okay, what's the mental state of Putin? Do we have any indications of what's his state of mind? Because the question of the use of nuclear forces has been brought up by not only Putin himself, also by Lavrov and others. And if you have a leader of the second most powerful nuclear power in the world, and you have the feeling that there is an element of instability in the that person, this is very threatening, very, very worrying. How do you see the mindset of Putin in, as far as we know, from the outside perspective? We are all not inside the Kremlin or inside his mind.
I think actually from the outside, none of us can possibly know that question. I think even people inside would have to look into that and examine him to have any sense of that. But I think that's the wrong way to think about it. Instead, you should look at what Putin has been saying about Ukraine going back to the Orange Revolution, 18 years ago. And he's been saying these same things to a certain degree. The issue of Ukraine, the issue of NATO, the issue of American forces in Europe, the strategic threat that NATO poses, all of that has been part of his thinking now for almost two decades. And when it's disturbing to hear a leader rattle the nuclear saber, because who wants to hear that? I mean, it's suddenly we have memories of the Cold War again. I think it's very much in keeping with a character that we've seen over the last 20 years. And it's becoming more extreme. Obviously, it got to the point where Putin was so frustrated, so paranoid or intimidated by the West that he felt the need to, launch this invasion. Was that a rational act? I mean, I think all of us who look at it as a mistake, a miscalculation, would say, no, that's not rational. I mean, how could you destroy everything you've built in the country? As Nina was saying, I mean, the prosperity of Russians is infinitely higher than it was when he took office. And yet that's all come crumbling down. And that doesn't mean he's crazy. I think it just means he didn't anticipate what the reaction would be. I think he misjudged the sanctions after Crimea and thought he'd get, a similar slap on the wrist, which Russia would be able to absorb. And so he didn't anticipate the unified reaction, not only of the United States and Europe, but Japan, South Korea, Singapore, today New Zealand. I mean, countries are not accepting this war in Europe. They're appalled by it, and they're acting, I think, in a more vigorous way than they ever have before.
Nina Khrushcheva, what about the reactions of Russian society? We have seen anti-war demonstrations, small but consistent, in Russian cities, hundreds of them, thousands of people who accepted to go to prison, knowing that they would go to prison to protest the war. Just this week, a young lady in the big TV show of state television went with a banner against the war. In Vienna, we have Russian shops and they have signs, "Niet войне, no to war." Is the anti-war feeling something that could be growing in Russia, or is the propaganda so hard and so efficient that Putin will, even in case that the whole thing lasts weeks and months, maintain the control, his control over Russian society?
Well, he will maintain the control. There are two things, actually, I wanted to say from previous. They made the nuclear arms ready, but I would still not say, not that I would pass it by him, I still would not say that he's nuclear arms rattling. I think it's more the conversation of what he might do rather than him saying that he's going to do it. So, and I think this distinction is still important, because when the West takes signs and discuss them as the reality, then actually the Russians have an excuse and explanation to say, well, they told us so, we're just going to do it. So I would be more careful with how the Russians approach the Kremlin approaches the nuclear threat. Not that the threat is not there. For the Russian society, yes, there is they've been, at the beginning was such a shock. I mean, I think Stephen is completely correct saying we've gotten to this stage getting to this stage for 15 years because Putin has been, he's nothing but consistent. I mean, he's very consistent in things that he says. But the reason it's such a shock for everybody, because suddenly all these warnings and his complaints got off the cliff so badly, because he would have been fine, continue to move these troops around and keep threatening. I mean, he doesn't have to go just full-blown dictator on us. So I think in this sense, it's not about his mental state, but when dictator becomes a dictator and stops being an authoritarian and autocrat, it's in a whole new level of irrational behavior, because there is a map in his mind, and that map has nothing to do with what reality is. The Russians were shocked by this, because they woke up in the morning after that speech at 5 a.m. on how Ukraine is essentially us, which is going to go and take it. And then they went to protest, and the initial anti-war sentiment was very large. But then the sanctions started falling on, and it's not just the economic sanctions, it's also social, political, societal, there's no PDF documents, there's no Microsoft, there is no Uniqlo, there is no iPhone, there is no McDonald's, which is the iconic place
on
Pushkin Square, exactly. It was sort of the sign of first freedom in 1990. And so that's that message that Putin has been trained on the Russians, that the West is out to get us, and it's an economic, it's a financial and economic war on the Russians, and we have to withstand because they hate us, and it's Russophobia all the way. In fact, many people actually now think that it is, because, you know what, of course, this tiny little thing, because Putin is, I have a niece who's 20 years old, and she goes to protest. She was arrested a couple of times just for walking. Her phone was checked if she has anti-Putin messages or something. And so she wrote to me, like, what do they want to do? And she's anti-Putin firmly. What does the West want to do? He doesn't go to McDonald's. He doesn't use Instagram. He doesn't go to buy a hat at Uniqlo. So it's all against us. And so now there is a lot of animosity also against the war,
but also against
the West.
Do people know what's going on in Ukraine?
Yes, yes. I mean, with a firm propaganda, they're still connected. I mean, yes, they closed, journalists and a lot of Western-oriented people fled, but there are still Telegram channels, which everybody subscribes to, is not closed. There's still YouTube channels that provide information. So it's not China. So you still, it's still Facebook. I mean, Facebook is slowed down, but you can do it through other services. So people do know what's going on. But that's why the kind of the trick of the special operation is that, when your country is so hated by everybody, and it's not just Putin. I mean, the price of an empire, that all Russians become guilty of Putinism. It doesn't happen with Belarus. Alexander Lukashenko is a tyrant, but the Belarusians are exempt from him being a tyrant. Russians are not exempt from Putinism. We are all guilty. We are all branded as, you know, when you're an imperial country, that's how the world looks at you. And so, yes, they do have the information, but also when the whole world is against you, you ultimately start picking and choosing the information that doesn't hurt your brain as much. So people do rally around the flag, even if there are great protests against the war.
Stephen Niemeyer, this sanction that Nina is mentioning, obviously in such a situation, it's logic that there are economic sanctions against companies that are producing, they are involved in the armament and involved in military business. But a huge amount of sanctions is directed or is felt by normal Russian citizens. I mean, the example of the McDonald's on Pushkin Square is really striking. Are the Europeans and the Americans not helping Putin isolate the country and isolate his society with a lot of these sanctions? The fact that artists, conductors, musicians are boycotted because it's not clear if they said something nice about Putin or not. Isn't that pretty crazy to help a tyrant like Putin isolate his country?
Well, obviously, I don't think the intention is to help. And a lot of...
Maybe the objective consequence.
Well, a lot of critics of Russia for years have been saying they needed to do this, that they needed to make sanctions hurt and hurt people around Putin. And for the first time that's happening, you're seeing yachts being seized around Europe. And you know, those are not targeting Russian people. You know, the vast majority of Russians, like the vast majority of Americans, can't even dream of owning a yacht worth $500 million. I think that they're hoping in the U.S. and in Europe that by targeting and restricting these kinds of assets of people who are at the top of the system, who have benefited from Putinism for the last two decades, that it will have them, you know, put pressure on Putin. I don't think it's going to work personally, you know, but it is going to punish Russia. And there is a sense of collective punishment here. And the question, I guess, and this is probably not for me to answer, it's for political theorists, is the question of collective responsibility and whether or not Russians in some way, and I totally agree with Nina, I mean, like every Russian that I know has been absolutely appalled by this war, and even if they can't say that publicly, they believe that privately, and they're going to pay a price for it, unfortunately. And but I think the calculation has been made that this is such an egregious violation, not only of another nation's sovereignty, but of the very security of Europe itself, that extraordinary measures are required. And that's going to, unfortunately, punish everybody in Russia. It's going to punish the rest of the world, to be honest, because the economy is worldwide. China is extremely worried about what's happening right now. And so, you know, whether or not that's the right thing, it's not for me to say, but I think that's the logic behind
this. As European citizens and American citizens, I mean, isn't it, if we come to the conclusion, the only force that would stop Putin to follow through his aggression must probably come from Russia, out of Russian society. So then why don't we make a big distinction? Say, okay, we don't want to block contacts with Russian citizens. We don't want to people not to be able to go to McDonald's. We don't want to have students problems because they can get money from their families. That's the case, for instance, in Vienna. Russian students here, they get monthly money from their families, the money can't arrive anymore. I mean, these are all measures that hit normal citizens, should not make a big distinction, say, yes, we want to intensify contact. I would say to intensify contact with Russian society, not to make it more difficult. And at the same time, yes, of course, the yacht and the military activity in Russia has to be boycotted. Why is it not possible to make that decision, this distinction?
I think actually people are making that distinction. And I've seen people criticizing the notion that, like, we should no longer have Russian artists performing. And, you know, ballet dancers have been put on the spot to say, are you for or against the war? And if you're for it, then out. You know, I think those kinds of things are not constructive. You know, obviously, communication, cultural exchange is the most important thing that can happen between two warring countries, just because it can minimize some of the disinformation or the vilification that goes on in a war. You know, I will point out that the vilification of Americans in Russia is equally bad. And also maybe less so with Europeans. And, you know, we're in a situation now where we're at war. And you know, the United States and NATO, frankly, are not involved in this. I mean, they're not fighting this conflict, but obviously they've taken a side, and they've taken the side of Ukraine. And, you know, that's created this standoff. And, I you know, Nina mentioned World War III earlier, and I agree. I mean, I think we're close to the beginning of that. And I think that the sanctions, as blunt an instrument as they can be, are the way that the U.S. feels, the U.S. and its allies, I should say, in Europe, feel that they can have an impact on this short of warfare. And, you know, that's where we are right now. And I agree, the consequences of it are awful. And you know, the consequence of war is awful. And we're just stuck in this this clash that I think everybody would have hoped we could have avoided.
Nina Khrushcheva, how to stop Putin? Obviously, there must be a point, or there will be a point, where this aggression will have to stop. Do you see forces within Russian society who would at a certain moment tell the Kremlin, it's enough, we have to find a compromise, to find a way out? And what's the role of outside forces in such a process?
Well, I just want to say that essentially the Russians already feel we're at war. I mean, maybe they're still not, I mean, they're, unlike Ukrainians, they're not being killed, but this blackout of Russia, sort of North Koreanization of Russia, the Talibanization from the inside and also from the outside, it certainly feels like war. And the idea is that you deprive Russians of livelihoods or something that they got accustomed to being part of the global community. And then they go to the streets and protest Putin and take out. So this is kind of an American favorite way of, you know, we love the regime change that can happen. And when I was talking to the young people, and they say, well, fine, we go to the streets, we protest, but now with all these completely draconic laws against, you know, for the national security of any form, so they either shoot us or we go to prison for 20 years. Is that what the West wants? So the protests are there, that's incredibly brave. I don't see, unless they're 10 millions, 20 millions, 50 millions go to the streets, as Alexei Navalny suggests, the anti-corruption lawyer speaks from prison. That's not going to work. And I don't see how many people, would they meet that many people, because even in Navalny's calculations, there are about 30% of Russian against the war. So 70 is four. So that's not really big. I mean, it's a lot, but not enough. It should be the other way around. Then there is some hope for the people revolution against Putin. For the oligarchs, something that everybody was hoping, that the yachts would be gone and, you know, they would go against him. And as I mentioned, I think that now, because the security forces really run the state, the oligarchs have no say, because the only thing that they have left with all the sanctions is whatever they have left in Russia. So if they go against the state, they're done, gone, their own prison. So that doesn't work. So my scenario, the way it can end, I mean, you know, I have three scenarios that are one worse than another. I'm sorry, I'm not an optimist. tactical, since we talk about nuclear, tactical nuclear strike on Ukraine to end the war, the way Hiroshima and Nagasaki were done in 45, and say, well, Americans did it, we can do it. That's a very unlikely scenario, but it is a possibility, because Stephen mentioned that when Putin is...
But to force Ukraine to capitulation.
Right, to capitulate, to finish the war, the way it was ended in Japan in 45.
Horrible vision.
Horrible. I mean, as I said, there's three scenarios, one worse than another, and I start with the most improbable, but since we talk about nuclear, who knows what in the mind of this man who now really feels, as Stephen said, he's cornered. So every time he's cornered, he escalates rather than de-escalates. So the other one, they agree, so that, say, negotiations work, troops withdraw, Putin is gone because he's too much of a toxic character. Still, KGB, FSB, the security forces, they now run the state. We see it in the streets. They are the ones who say national security, Russian, not even greatness in Putin's historical understanding, you know, the ruling over the Slavic lands, but sort of Russian security against the West, because ultimately the West will still come after us one day. So we have to be closed, we have to be inside ourselves, without Putin, probably slightly more connections with the world, but still a reasonably black hole. And the last one, Putin stays, war ends with some sort of agreement, and we're equally in the same black hole as before, but because Putin isn't there, it's even more toxic, and he is more angry, and the country is more Talibanish, because he's going to go back. We'll be asking Ivan the Terrible who, because comparing to what awaits Russia with the increased Putinism is going to be even worse.
Stephen Limayos, what can China do? The Americans are trying to get China into the picture. There's been this meeting between the Chinese foreign policy chief National Security Advisor, U.S. National Security Advisor. Are the only really important ally of Russia in this whole business? There's been this big agreement between Xi Jinping and Putin in Beijing for friendship without limits. I think that was the quote. But China was all not happy with the way things. They said that quite often. We are not happy how things turned out. Could China intervene in order to help Putin get out of this corner?
It's a great question, and the short answer is probably no. I don't think that Putin is going to be any more influenced by China than he would be by anyone else in the way he's making decisions. I do think that the statement that they agreed to on February 4th, the day of the opening ceremony of the Olympics, when it was clear at that point, I think, that Putin had made a decision to act forcefully against Ukraine, though maybe not at this level. Putin was seeking backup from China in that statement, which didn't mention Ukraine, but it mentioned NATO expansion and said that shouldn't continue. So that was an implicit reference to Ukraine. And it talked about their joint animosity towards American led efforts to promote democracy, because in fact there are many kinds of democracy. Russia is a democracy, China is. And so I think that Putin took comfort from that, took solace that he had this giant power, much, much bigger than Russia in economic terms, behind him. And I think that probably emboldened him somewhat. And what we've seen since then, and admittedly, politics in China are even more of a black box than they are in the Kremlin. But it's clear that they are not at all comfortable with what's happened. And you can tell by the fact that the Chinese media and Chinese officials didn't even know how to respond in the beginning. And since they haven't in any way retreated from their support of Russia from the statement that they signed only a month ago. But they've made it clear by expressing support for Ukraine's sovereignty and calling for peace talks and so forth, that they're not in favor of this conflict. I think they're extremely...
They talk of war in the Chinese media and not of special military operation, don't they?
The Chinese media has largely echoed the Russian media. But like in Russia, there have been voices that have kind of permeated that. And you know, there is a debate that's going on among the Chinese elite about how to respond to this. And there was an op-ed published this last weekend from a scholar who's, you know, been on committees advising the government, suggesting that China should cut bait and drop Putin at this point, because it's not worth going down with Putin, given the international reaction to this. I do think that one of China's core principles is the sacrosanct national sovereignty. And Putin's violated that in the case of Ukraine, clearly. I mean, they can say that it's justified, that it's the U.S., it's NATO, and so forth, but they can't get around the idea that Putin has done something that is one of their core foreign policy principles, or they claim it to be. And so they've been put into a very awkward position. And I think China's influence in this will be in not being so vocal in their support, and also what they do to bail out Russia. And, you know, the United States reported over the weekend that Russia had requested not only economic assistance, but military assistance from China. And the question now is, will China give that? And, you know, they just dismiss this as fake news. But I think that there's probably a great deal of reticence from the Chinese, that they do not want to be seen as the arms supplier to Russia at this point either. So if they were to withhold that kind of support, you know, who's Putin going to turn to now?
I just wanted to ask you, Stephen, because one of the reasons Putin did this miscalculation and go into Ukraine and was preparing for sanctions, as he said, or his team was saying that they prepared for sanctions, because they were relying on China to have where the West left off, right? So if China doesn't step in to buy oil, to provide airplane parts and so on and so forth, so that means the miscalculation of Putin is even grander, although I don't know how more grand it can be, but even grander than it originally appeared, because if Russia is completely alone on the world stage, then it is even more finished that we discussed, correct?
Yeah, I think that's right. But I will point out also, though, that I don't think China is going to cut off the supply of gas and oil. What they're going to do is get it for a discount. And that's what they did in 2014 when, you know, the initial sanctions on Russian energy were imposed during the Obama administration. Putin came to China, asked for a deal in rubles, and the Chinese said, no thanks, we'll take it in dollars. And they negotiated an incredible discount in the price at the time. And I think that a lot of people in China, and we had a story about this just today, are looking at how essentially they can take advantage of this situation, you know, distance themselves somewhat from the carnage that's happening on the ground, you know, express support for a peaceful resolution. You know, I don't think they're going to force companies to violate the international sanctions. You know, so they'll more or less comply with them, even as they criticize sanctions as a tool. But, you know, so far energy is not sanctioned, so they'll let the tap flow and appreciate the bargain that they're going to get.
One more question, tiny question. What about those territories? You and I discussed at length the territories over the Amur River. Do you think the Chinese may demand the territories for a little bit of support in those in the Far East?
It's a great question, and in the you know, far quarters of the Chinese internet, you will often find references to Vladivostok, once being a Chinese city, and so forth. But seriously, I don't think that that's the kind of calculation that, that China would make. I mean, they with Russia settled their border dispute and demarked the border now some years ago, 2006, I believe. And, you know, I don't expect that China will be eyeing, you know, Siberia now for anything other than the natural resources that they can get through trade and so forth. And
but if you want to come to a compromise somehow and not to avoid these horrible scenarios that Nina had been mentioning, to force Ukraine into capitulation through the most horrible use of arms that you can imagine, it must come from somewhere. So should it not be a tempting idea for the Chinese president, Xi Jinping, the Chinese emperor helps to create peace in far lands in Europe, would enhance the position of China in the world. The Europeans would forget about Hong Kong and forget about Xinjiang, and the position of China in the world would really be improved. Is that not something that, from the logic of the Chinese leadership, to be a world power independently of what other crazy allies are doing, that could enhance China's role in the world, but the Chinese have to take risks, of course, and the risk is to intervene in that completely blocked situation. But is that not a temptation, do you think, for Beijing?
More than a temptation, I think it's what they're trying to do right now. And their calls with the Yang Jiechi, who met with Jake Sullivan yesterday in Rome, they're calling for international support for peace negotiations. The challenge, and you already hit on it, is that it's risky. It's risky to put the prestige of your leader on the line in trying to broker a deal between combatant parties. As interested as they might be in some sort of resolution emerging, that they're not really, so far anyway, demonstrating any initiative in trying to broker their own set of talks. One person I talked to today who does advise the government indirectly, at least, and talked about creating something like the six-party talks, if you remember, that were initially held to denuclearize Korea, that kind of role where you could have the permanent members of the Security Council with Ukraine and with the European Union sit down somewhere like Geneva and come up with a compromise. The problem is, I think the compromise is not really clear, and Putin hasn't backed off any of his demands yet. And they are maximalist. And so it's hard to imagine how China could push Russia toward something that would be acceptable to the West as well.
You're talking to us from Seoul, from South Korea, and there's been, 70 years ago, the Korean War. Could that war in Ukraine end in a way maybe similar to the Korean War, with a demarcation line between West and East in the case of Ukraine, North and South in the case of Korea, and Russia and the Russian part of Ukraine turning into a big North Korea? Is that something? Nina mentioned the North Korean variant for Putin, but Russia is a huge country. North Korea is much smaller to cut that off from the rest of the world. But is this Korean scenario something that could help us to understand what's possible?
It's a great question, and actually it's probably that nightmare would be the most optimistic outcome that we could hope for right now. A divided Ukraine, perpetually at war with its neighbor, the superpowers lined up on either side of it. And I don't see that being a positive conclusion, but it's better than some of the scenarios that Nina laid out.
But actually, I think, because the reason I didn't make this up, because we already have it. I don't think we actually need to aspire to this, because we already have the recognition of Donetsk and Luhansk. They now, the Russians liberated those territories almost to the regional borders of it. And so that's how it's going. It's already there. So I don't think this is an aspirational scenario. We already have the Ukraine divided and the
Dnieper being the separation line between East and West.
Right, between Ukraine. So now they have all this.
If I could interject, the fighting's not over. And so, yes, that seems to be where they are right now. And it seems to be certainly part of the, if you just look at the battle map, they're clearly trying to link Donbas to Crimea, perhaps all the way to Odessa, but it's not done. And so, we might be in the beginning of the Korean War, not the end of it right now.
Could be, but it's already, they already connected Crimea to the land, through the land to those parts that they liberated or occupied in Donetsk, in those regions of Donetsk and Luhansk. So we could be at the beginning of the Korean War, not the end of it, but we're very close to that aspiration. So it's not a positive scenario, but it seems to be, at least for now, the scenario that we are almost having as reality, and all others are potential.
What would the consequences for Russia be if Putin wins the war, in the sense of there is a puppet regime in Kiev and control over Ukraine in the way that after a victory, imperial power controls the country? What would be the consequences in Russia? And also the other way, if Putin loses the war, in the sense the Ukrainian resistance prevails and succeeds to create an impossible situation and the Russians have to give up some of their goals, what would be the consequences in Russia in both cases?
Well, I think Putin already lost the war. Because even if there is a puppet regime, although I don't believe it will get to it, frankly, I think they're already way deep into many problems. But then I don't believe it's going to last long, because Ukraine is going to put up a defense like Russians now seeing, and they have not seen yet. So Ukraine is not going to stay an occupied power for long, I don't believe.
So it's rather like Afghanistan. You have
the like of
resistance.
Resistance is going to be for many years. Or everybody would leave. I mean, now it's 45 million people, maybe five by now already fled, although we have the numbers of 3 million, but probably more. So it's going to become a country of, 20 million if we are lucky. Possibly. But it's not a victory for Ukraine in Ukraine, but it's certainly an incredible loss for Russia. So they gain this territory yet again, but it doesn't really give them any promises for the future, any positive outcome in any other way. But also Putin, I know he's, and Stephen and I spoke about it a lot, Stephen is very concerned about his mortality. Like all despots at the waning years of their lives, they really become quite obsessed. I mean, Stalin was very obsessed with him living forever. Putin is going to, he's mortal, he's going to be gone one day. And the fact that we can imagine that this improbable situation that we're in will continue is very hard to imagine. Because also, as I said, it is a KGB state in a sense, it's a security state, the Putinism state, even without Putin. Even if that continues, I don't know how this other security people in the apparatus who will continue to run the country be that interested in this whole Ukraine invasion, because it doesn't seem to be, for example, one of the reasons or one of the problems that I think the war, the invasion encountered is because the FSB people, the security people, didn't believe, they talk about Ukraine as part of the Slavic Pan-Slavic nation and we need it and so on. So they fed him all the information that, you know, the Nazi regime, they're preventing the Slavs from being Slavs. They need to be taken out. They were feeding him all the things he wanted to hear in absolute belief that he's not going to go there because that's just too much trouble for what it's worth. So that, in a sense, it's not going to last long. It can't last long. It can last for some time with Putin, but it's just not viable to last beyond him. So the loss is already there.
Stephen Limayos, if the war ends in a way that's seen as a victory for Putin, what would be the consequences? What would be the consequences if it ends in a way that's seen as a disaster for Putin? What would it mean for Russia?
I don't think it will end in a way that will seem a victory. I agree with Nina. It's just, even if they were to successfully conquer Ukraine and eliminate whatever resistance is there, everything that's in place now would remain. If anything, it would even harden because it would become a full conquest of a nation. The last time someone tried that was Saddam Hussein. In 1990. And so I think that the world opprobrium would just be so great that Russia would, you know, retreat into its isolation and so forth. I think that the more open question is, were he to lose on the battlefield? And, you know, it kind of depends on how he loses. So if there is a negotiated settlement that, you know, divides Ukraine along the Dnieper, then maybe he'll say, oh, I succeeded, and go back home and have a military parade for the heroes of the war. But he's still going to face the same isolation that he faces right now. So I don't honestly see an optimistic scenario where Putin pulls this off somehow and, you know, is able to then reassert his primacy, is his legacy in Russia. I think too much has been destroyed now for that to happen.
For Russia, a big North Korea, that's how you see it, and then Putin, a big Kim Jong-un or whatever.
I mean, Russian society, I think, is never going to be as isolated as that. There are too many Russians who travel freely around Europe, around the U.S., family, the diaspora is huge. And, you know, that's not going to change. North Korea truly is a hermit nation. And, you know, so few people are able to get in or out. I think Russia will, you know, go through this period in kind of wandering in the desert, if you will, where they're going to be, you know, figuring out why are we so isolated. You know, it's interesting. Nina mentioned the surveys about support for the war. And, you know, yeah, some of them, you can't really trust surveys in Russia, to be honest, but some of them suggest that there's majority support. But one I saw was 56% for the war. And if that's even close to true, your nation has gone to war and 44% of the population doesn't support it. That's an extraordinary figure because people generally do rally around the flag of their country when, you know, soldiers are in harm's way. And so that the idea that it would not be closer to 80 or 90% is kind of shocking in itself. And again, I don't think the Russians as a people want to see this war. I don't think they want to see themselves isolated from the world. I think they want to be able to travel to Europe and travel the world like everybody does. Go to Turkey and go to Egypt for vacation. No one wants to retreat into this hermit kingdom again, the way it was in the Soviet times. And, you know, it's interesting, even that the elites, you know, who owe everything to Putin and who have done nothing to show anything but loyalty to him, you know, they're all with assets in Europe now being seized in some cases, you know, they don't want to cut themselves off like that either. And so, you know, I'm not suggesting that the sanctions are going to change the course that Putin's on, but I do think it's going to make people in Russia question who they are and what they want to be as a nation, as a culture. And while there are certainly voices that look down on the decadent liberal West and so forth. I don't think anyone wants to be at war with the West.
Nina Khrushcheva, final thoughts?
I agree. I think that Russians may, in theory, want to have a great country that is respected and feared by the West. But they also want, and they have accustomed to normal, I wouldn't even say Western lifestyle, but normal lifestyle, something that North Korea has never experienced. So it is going to be when the world is actually closed and the Russian state will close the remaining possibility to travel because they would be, Putin always goes and his security forces go into overdrive. Then those who so much wanted back the Soviet Union because we were respected and we were a superpower, they would know exactly what it means to be in the Soviet Union. And I just don't think it's going to end well. I'm still not certain that people would really go to the streets because they Russians are slow with revolutions, but one day that may happen. But I don't think, I just don't think we have enough information to predict whether it's going to make Putin more supported by the people because they have no other place to go, or they would be a new Orange Revolution or Arab Spring or whatnot. What I do know is that they, if anything they're prepared for, is to make sure that no Orange Revolution happens. So that's what my niece was saying, what the West wants us to be killed in the streets. Because I think at this point, very soon, the security will be ready to shoot people if they protest. So we'll see how that plays out. So I personally do not see positive scenarios in how Russian situation will play out. However, as horrible as what Ukraine is going through right now, but I think they will emerge triumphant from this and they will be better than ever.
And maybe they'll have allies in Russian society, more allies than we may think of now. We should not, also as historians, underestimate the capacities of societies to rebel against the craziness of tyrants.
Yeah, but how do you do that? Because one of the things, and you actually mentioned this, put very well, is that the problem, once again, as Stephen was talking about, collective responsibility, because that's the price of an empire. If you're part of an empire, you're responsible for the whole thing from top to bottom. Somehow, is that, all this, fine, McDonald's, we can figure out if we can live without it. But the fact that Nordic Council stopped supporting projects that journalists, remaining few independent journalists, are doing in Russia because it's Russia, that British scientists stopped working with the Russian scientists, regardless of how they, it's not even those who didn't denounce Putin, just generally they stopped any project. So it is, the society is being punished for Putin, and it seems to be sort of this brouhaha, great, wonderful thing that we're sanctioning the Russians, but they're also sanctioning and eliminating whatever is left of civil society there. And I think that hopefully the West will wake up soon enough and will stop punishing Russians on that level. Because if anything, whoever is left there in the society needs to be an ally of the West against Putin, not a supporter of Putin, because the West has completely cut Russia out.
One of the consequences of that discussion, contact with civil society in Russia, wherever they are possible.
As it was in the Cold War.
Not only be stopped, they should be intensified.
Absolutely.
And that may not change the war in the next 2 or 3 weeks, but it may, on the long term, help us get out of this dead end of history. Thank you very much for your insight. Thank you, Steve, in Seoul, and thank you, Nina Khrushcheva, here in the Kreisky Forum in Vienna. These are dangerous times, and we have to stay alert. Thank you for your interest, and bye-bye.
Das war eine Diskussionsrunde im Bruno Kreisky Forum in Wien, aufgezeichnet am 15. März 2022 mit der Russland-Expertin Nina Khrushcheva und dem New York Times-Korrespondenten Stephen Lee Myers. Ich bedanke mich wie immer sehr herzlich beim Bruno Kreisky Forum für die Zusammenarbeit. Ich verabschiede mich von allen, die uns auf UKW hören, im Freirad Tirol und auf Radio Agora in Kärnten. Ausführliche Berichte aus der Ukraine und über die Ukraine finden Sie im Falter. Ein Abonnement des Falter informiert Sie und es ist ein Beitrag für echten europäischen Journalismus. Ein Falter-Abo bekommen Sie über die Internetseite abo.falter.at. Ursula Winterauer hat die Signation gestaltet, Philipp Dietrich betreut die Audiotechnik im Falter. Ich verabschiede mich, bis zur nächsten Folge.